Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, we'll take a closer look at the Iran nuclear deal. Our reporter shares observations about the Egyptian vote. We speak with an author about a new report on children and inequality.
One of the surprising things in the report, though, was just how far these disadvantages spread into other elements of well-being.
And hear about a new movie, possibly inspiring tomorrow's space travelers. It's right here on the Voice of America. President Obama has welcomed Adoption Day, which occurred Sunday, the 90th day since the July 14th international nuclear agreement with Iran was endorsed by the UN Security Council. Now the process of compliance to the terms of the deal is supposed to begin. My colleague Victor Beatty is following the story and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. In a statement issued Sunday, Mr. Obama said Tehran must take steps to remove thousands of centrifuges and associated infrastructure, reduce its enriched uranium stockpile, and remove the core of the Iraq heavy water reactor and render it unusable. The president, at a Friday news conference, cautioned the agreement only removes one irritant in its dealings with Iran.
The Iran nuclear deal solves a specific problem, which is making sure that they don't possess a nuclear weapon. And it's our best way to do that. It does not fully resolve the wide range of issues where we've got a big difference. So we are going to have to continue to put pressure on them through the international community and where we have bilateral channels, to indicate to them that there are costs to bad behavior in the region and around the world. But we're not going to do that more effectively if they're also on a separate track pursuing a nuclear weapon.
The next step in the process is Implementation Day, when the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, verifies Tehran has fulfilled its obligations and international sanctions are lifted. Sunday, Mr. Obama directed that U.S. agencies begin preparations to lift nuclear-related sanctions. The European Union began a similar process on Sunday. Obama administration officials insist that sanctions will end only when the IAEA verification is complete. They say that could take months. Iran has demanded immediate lifting of all sanctions, but regional analyst Stephen Zunis at the University of San Francisco told me the delay was part of the give and take of the deal.
The Iranians, of course, wanted everything lifted immediately upon the signing of the agreement. Those United States wanting them to hold out until they had certified they had met all the requirements. And what we have is a compromise that some sanctions will be lifted as Iran complies with the proviso that the full sanctions would snap back in if they were found to be violating it.
There is concern, of course, on a number of fronts with regard to Iran's behavior in the wake of this nuclear agreement. Fighters from Iran working with Russia in Syria, a Revolutionary Court convicted a Washington Post reporter who had been held for more than a year on charges including espionage. Two Americans being detained. The U.S. has asked for Iran's assistance in finding another one. And Iran test-fired a guided long-range ballistic service-to-service missile, which U.S. officials insist did not violate the nuclear deal.
There are a number of outstanding issues between the United States and Iran, but this is not new for a nuclear agreement. The SALT agreement, the ABM treaty between the United States and Soviet Union, happened at a time when the United States was still bombing North Vietnam, when the two superpowers were battling for influence in Central America and Africa and elsewhere. There will still, as with the former Soviet Union, continue to be disputes between the countries who are signatories of this agreement. That's not a surprise. But the fact is this most important issue has been resolved amicably. It could open up for cooperation on these other fronts and should not get in the way of the implementation of the nuclear agreement.
Meanwhile, Ian Lustig, a Middle East analyst from the University of Pennsylvania, says Iran's full compliance would say a lot about Tehran's foreign policy objective.
One of the misapprehensions of the whole situation is just how committed Iran was to have a nuclear weapon compared to how committed it was to use its nuclear capacity to get the world to affirm its status as a legitimate power in the Middle East. It is succeeding in that regard because I don't believe it really cared that much about having a weapon, not the governing authorities. And one reason I say that is because the technology that so much attention has been directed to, the centrifuges, is a Rube Goldberg way to get a nuclear weapon. If they wanted a nuclear weapon, they could easily have done so through the North Korean route, through production of plutonium, a very dangerous kind of weapon, a very dangerous technology. And that technology is being completely removed under the terms of this agreement. Regardless of how many centrifuges they do or do not have at a certain point, the very fact that the plutonium route to a bomb will be removed is a crucial accomplishment of this agreement.
A lot has been made about how these sanctions will benefit Iran economically. Is that a concern vis-a-vis its human rights record and also its handling of its terrorist involvement?
You can't really keep money that is the Iranians' money from them just because you want them not to have a better standard of living or not to have more clout in the world. That's what international law and international comedy is all about. There's also the point that as Iran becomes more economically engaged with the rest of the world through various trade agreements, that this will, in indirect ways, over the long run, empower the majority of Iranians who want to move their country away from theocracy and towards some kind of true Islamic democracy. The economic side of that process is going to be just as important as this kind of diplomatic political side.
So you think this nuclear agreement could help change the political landscape in Iran?
Over the long run, yes, I do.
This week, envoys from the agreement signatories, the U.S., Britain, France, China, Germany, and Russia, are to meet in Vienna to form a commission to oversee implementation of the nuclear accord.
Thank you, Victor.
All right, Susan.
We just heard from two analysts who are optimistic about the Iran nuclear deal, but there is plenty of pessimism as well on social media. Our reporter Michael Lippin is here with that side of the story. Michael, what can you tell us about this?
Hi, Susan. Well, I've seen a couple of opinion pieces posted on Twitter today reflecting deep skepticism among some Americans about whether Iran will fulfill its part of the nuclear deal. The first one comes from the Washington Free Beacon news site, which has a conservative slant. Its handle is @FreeBeacon, and it's got 50,000 followers. It tweeted this headline today: Iranian leaders refuse to uphold nuclear deal. And it linked to a piece by writer Adam Credo. Credo writes that senior Iranian officials continue to lash out against the recent nuclear deal, even as the Obama administration begins to implement it. He says Iranian Ayatollah Ali Khamenei took to his Twitter and Facebook pages to post an announcement titled, "Negotiation with America is Forbidden." And he says that's according to translations of the documents provided by the Middle East Media Research Institute. Now, that research institute, which has the acronym MEMRI, is a like-minded conservative organization based here in D.C. It uses the Twitter handle @MEMRIReports, and it has 17,000 followers. MEMRI tweeted this yesterday: Iran Supreme Leader Khamenei and other Iranian officials speak out against Iranian approval of the JCPOA, which is the acronym for the Iran deal. It says that in the past few days, Iranian officials have clarified that Iran's Majlis, or parliament, has not approved the JCPOA, and neither have the Iran Supreme National Security Council and Guardian Council. In light of these developments, MEMRI says it is not clear whether Iran will officially announce its adoption of the JCPOA, so there's still a lot of uncertainty that needs to be cleared up about Iran's position on moving ahead with this deal. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists have created two new maps of Jupiter with data and images gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope's High Performance Wide Field Camera 3. The maps are a representation of two nearly continuous rotations of the solar system's largest planet. The new maps revealed some interesting new features on Jupiter. Among them is an odd wave that was observed just north of Jupiter's equator in an area flecked with storms. Another is an odd and delicate streamer-like feature that was spotted for the first time at the heart of the Great Red Spot, a giant storm spinning counterclockwise in the planet's southern hemisphere. Along with Jupiter, new maps will also be created annually of Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The long-delayed parliamentary elections in Egypt to fill the 596-member parliament will continue today in 14 of the 27 provinces. There was no official or reliable information available on Sunday's turnout, which many pundits predicted could be as low as 10%. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy is following this story, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Mohammed, as always.
Thank you.
What did you find out, Mohammed?
I monitored the turnout on Egyptian television, and to me, it's very slim turnout compared to the previous ones, especially the 2011 and 2012. Then I spoke with Marina Ottawi, a senior scholar at the Wilson Center's Middle East program, and I first asked her about what does the low turnout suggest in terms of youth participation and President Sisi's popularity.
What it shows is that people do not believe that the parliament is going to change anything. It's certainly the youth is not voting, but neither are the grown-ups. I mean, from all the reports I have seen, the voter turnout has been dismally low, which means that people don't believe that this parliament is going to make a difference. I don't think we can read that either, meaning that people are against President Sisi or are in favor of him. It's just that they don't think that the parliament itself is going to count for anything. That would be my reading of the situation.
But what kind of message you see the Egyptian people sending by this low turnout?
Well, the message that they are sending is that they are too sophisticated to be taken in and that they do not believe that this is going to be a real parliament. The parliament, you know very well that the election law was written in order to bring about a fractured parliament. It is a parliament where you don't have blocks of representatives that can push for a program. So the most likely outcome is that this will be a parliament like the parliament in the days of Mubarak, when a lot of independent candidates ended up by voting alongside the way the government wanted in order to curry favor, in order to get patronage for their districts and so on. And therefore, they realized that, you know, even if they vote, nothing is going to change.
So you think that would lead to a new legislature which will overwhelmingly support Sisi and his agenda and maybe becoming again a rubber stamp?
That's what I think. Some people believe that it's going to be to create a very fractured parliament that is going to give Sisi trouble. I don't believe that's going to be the case because there will not be, because political parties will not be represented in a strong way, and certainly not political parties that are likely to oppose Sisi in any way. So, I don't think this is going to that parliament is going to decrease the president's political power, but it's not going to give him any support either because it will be an unrepresentative parliament.
So to sum it up, Sue, Egyptian voters appear to have shunned the first phase of a parliamentary election that President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi had hailed as a milestone on the road to democracy.
Yes, but this is significant anyway because they are actually voting.
Yes, but let's wait and see.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mohammed, for bringing us this insight.
Thank you, Sue.
Coming up on International Edition, poverty hurting kids more than we may think, and learning to survive on Mars. Children are paying a high price for inequality in the world, according to a new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. OECD spokesperson and co-author of the report, Carrie Exton, joins us on the line. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Oh, thank you. What in general did the report find?
So there are a number of different elements covered in the report, but one of the things that we focused on for the first time this year was well-being among children. And there are some quite remarkable results. Even within OECD countries, and we're talking about 34 of the wealthiest countries in the world, we find that child poverty, for example, 1 in 7 children are living in income poverty. 1 in 10 children in OECD households are living in homes where no one works. So even among the most affluent countries, we're seeing high levels of children not getting a good start in life.
Other than the obvious reason of money, how do advantage and disadvantaged children differ in their lives?
So this was actually one of the surprising results, because obviously you would expect that among more disadvantaged groups, the material living conditions are worse, so the housing conditions might be worse, the levels of poverty might be worse. One of the surprising things in the report, though, was just how far these disadvantages spread into other elements of well-being. So if we look at, for example, some of the child health outcomes, among children from the most affluent families, only 11% of children report being in poor health. When we look at the poorer families, that rises up to 18% of children. Similarly, we have much higher rates of obesity among less affluent families. And we also see that relationships, both with peers and parents, tend to be worse among the less affluent children.
And you're talking about things that don't change. This could affect their entire lives.
This indeed is one of the reasons why it's so worrying, because we're seeing this transmission over the generations of disadvantage, and it's really something that we need to break that cycle.
Well, how do we go about doing that?
I think one of the important things about this report is that it's telling us when we think about children in disadvantage, we need to think beyond just the material conditions in which they're living. So children living in households with lower income, the parents might need a lot of support in a lot of different areas of their lives.
What about volunteering and that sort of thing? Something that an average person could do.
Volunteering is another feature in this report. It's the first time that we've tried to collect comparative data across a wide variety of different countries on volunteering. And indeed, it's absolutely one of the findings that we report is that volunteering essentially offers win-wins for well-being. So we see that volunteering has advantages for communities, but it also actually is beneficial to the volunteers themselves. They tend to have higher well-being than non-volunteers.
So this report is really a signpost for folks to know that this needs to change.
Yes. I mean, one of the sort of unique features of this report is the variety of dimensions of life that we cover. We're really going much beyond GDP to try and understand ways in which life could get better for ordinary people.
And the name of the report, so folks can go online and find out about it?
It's called How's Life 2015.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Carrie.
Thank you very much.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Martian is a film about a marooned astronaut who uses science, wit, and courage to survive in a very hostile environment. The movie is making hundreds of millions of dollars and has gotten some very good reviews. Some scientists also are saying the film from 20th Century Fox has the potential to inspire as well as entertain. VOA's Michael Lippin has the story.
In The Martian, Mark Watney is a U.S. astronaut who has to survive alone on Mars after his crew leaves the planet without him, thinking he died in a storm that swept him away.
Luckily, I'm a botanist.
The botanist, played by Matt Damon, is not a typical Hollywood hero, but he is one of several role models in the film for aspiring scientists.
Begin abort procedure.
Another is Mars Mission Commander Melissa Lewis, played by Jessica Chastain. It's a performance that excites Costa Rican space enthusiast and student Montserrat Cordero, who appeared on hashtag VOA via Skype.
Jessica Chastain's character is amazing. We also have the computer programmer, who's also a woman. Like, this is not what we tend to see, so really excited to see this kind of thing. Hope to see a lot more of it.
Cordero is a graduate of an international summer school run by the Foundation for International Space Education in Houston, Texas. Its director of educational programs told hashtag VOA via Skype that the Martians' role models will have a positive influence.
The more women we have involved in science, technology, and engineering and math, the better society we have, and the better we'll be able to accomplish those missions and do things like go to Mars.
In the film, U.S. government space agency NASA tries to overcome great obstacles to bring Watney back to Earth. That's not just science fiction. The science and technology you see in the movie is based on real-life work by NASA, which acted as an advisor to the filmmakers. And the work being done here at NASA headquarters in Washington includes preparations for an actual manned mission to Mars. As part of that effort, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory has been operating rovers to collect Martian soil samples. Speaking to hashtag VOA via Skype, the laboratory's Mars engineering manager says his team needs diversity to succeed.
People from who see the world from different angles to come in and bring their creative ideas with them to come here to help us out. So, you know, this, what we do here is really, in many respects, an international effort.
NASA hopes The Martian will help that effort by inspiring young scientists everywhere to bring humans to Mars by the 2030s.
I've done the math. Checks out.
Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
Rich. Yes, sir.
Get out.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us today for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world's ocean is the Earth's greatest resource. It produces much of our oxygen, regulates our climate, and supports the greatest abundance of life on our planet. All life is inextricably tied to it, so if the ocean were to disappear today, nearly every creature, every plant would soon follow. Nonetheless, we humans have not been the best caretakers of our ocean, wrote Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, in a recent article. The world's fish stocks are depleted and continue to be overfished. Plastic debris is choking our waters, and the carbon we are pumping into the air is increasing water acidity. So we are doing something about it. The health of our ocean was part of the Sustainable Development Summit at the recently held 70th session of the UN General Assembly. Members adopted the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, a blueprint that will guide global development over the next 15 years. In doing so, they pledged to work toward conservation and sustainable use of the ocean and marine resources. Following on the heels of the UN conference is our Ocean Conference, which recently took place in Santiago, Chile. 500 representatives of governments, academia, the private sector, and civil society worked to find solutions to overfishing, plastic pollution, and ocean acidification. They are continuing the work begun at the first Our Ocean Conference, which took place in Washington last year. At the time, participants from 90 countries announced new partnerships and initiatives and committed to promote sustainable fisheries, reduce pollution, monitor and prevent acidification, and pledged to protect over 3 million square kilometers of the ocean. there is a growing understanding that a healthy and resilient ocean will help drive widespread and shared prosperity, including economic, food, energy security, and will ensure the health of our planet for generations to come, said Undersecretary Novelli. The United States and its partners around the world have been working together to tackle challenges such as ocean acidification, unsustainable fishing, and marine debris. And we've made a lot of progress, and so our momentum going forward is only going stronger.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.